Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Big Bend Sentinel for Thursday, June 16th, 2022. Trial date set for Leach defamation case against alleged victim by Allegra Hobbs, A-L-L-E-G-R-A at BigBendSentinel.com. Brewster County. A trial date of December 12, 2022 has been set for the defamation suit brought by Base Camp Terlingua owner Jeff Leach against a former employee who accused him of assault. Leach sued Katie Milam, who also goes by Schwartz, in 2019 for defamation and intentional infliction of emotional distress when she told authorities that Leach had held her down and said, quote, "he gets what he wants," end quote. The suit has since then been dismissed, made its way through an El Paso appeals court, and been returned to trial court in Brewster County, where it now awaits trial. Judge Stephen Abels had initially tossed the suit in early 2020, stating Milam was protected by free speech laws, but the 8th Court of Appeals in El Paso reversed that decision in May, citing missed deadlines. The dismissal in 2020 was made under the Texas Citizens Participation Act, which protects people from being sued for exercising their legal rights, and which comes with a statutory 60-day deadline for a hearing on the dismissal, though an extension to 90 days can be granted. Because the dismissal in the case was granted past the 90-day deadline, the appeals court determined that, while the reasons for the missed deadline were understandable, including a reshuffling of judges when the first recused himself and the second was objected to by Leach, it could not ignore the statute. Though the civil suit drags on, a criminal case against Leach was recently dismissed. After Leach sued Milam, several other women came forward with accusations of rape and assault. One of those accusations led to Leach's indictment on a felony sexual assault charge. The case had been poised to go to trial, but the Office of 83rd Judicial District Attorney Ori White in May filed a motion to dismiss the case, citing insufficient evidence. A judge subsequently signed off on the dismissal. The woman whose accusation had led to Leach's indictment, Shauna Graves, submitted a statement to the court opposing the dismissal. Staff photo by Mary Cantrell. A small crowd of Marfa residents gathered last weekend with protest signs to promote gun reform in a march down Highland Avenue. School board and city council partner on grant to designate full-time safety officer for MISD as trustees consider permitting trained staff to carry firearms. By Mary Cantrell, MKCANTRELL at BigBendSentinel.com. Marfa. School safety was a major topic of discussion this week at the Marfa School Board and City Council meetings, with community leaders looking to act fast to bolster campus security in the wake of the mass elementary school shooting in Uvalde this May. "I just encourage you all to consider options for us so that we're no longer sitting ducks. In a utopian world, we would be full of law enforcement 24/7. But that's not reality," said MISD junior high and high school principal Luann Porter at a school board meeting Monday night. School board trustees at that meeting discussed the possibility of allowing trained teachers and staff to carry weapons on campus for student protection, while City Council on Tuesday approved a grant application with a letter of support from Superintendent Oscar Aguero, which would fund the placement of a full-time Armed School Resource Officer, SRO, on campus. Porter, previous counselor for the district, led the campus security discussion at the school board meeting. She introduced the board to two options, the school marshal and guardian plans, outlined by Texas Education and Penal Codes, that would allow for designated staff to carry firearms on campus for the purpose of protecting students. The district currently employs the avoid, deny, defend civilian response strategy in the case of an active shooter, a method of survival tactics to use during an active shooter event developed by Texas State's Advanced Law Enforcement Rapid Response Training, ALERT, program. But Porter said the strategy could only do so much, and having armed staff on campus might be the logical next step. We're not being realistic if we're asking our teachers to defend in an unarmed situation. It's just not realistic. What are we going to defend with? Said Porter. It's our responsibility to keep our kids and our staff safe. Of the 1,200 school districts in Texas, Porter said 280 utilize the Guardian Plan, which offers more flexibility for school districts, allowing boards to set their own training requirements and limits to the number of staff carrying, and 71 employ the Marshall Plan, which requires more rigorous training and gives school marshals a higher status of a law enforcement officer with arresting capabilities. The identities of staff who are permitted through either of the programs to have firearms on campus would not be disclosed to the students and general public, said Porter. Marshals are considered peace officers, must undergo a psychological evaluation, and can only use frangible ammunition, said Porter. In order to obtain a school marshal license, 80 hours of training with the Texas Commission on Law Enforcement is required, in addition to 16 hours of training every 2 years for license renewal. Under the Guardian program, the school district can determine the type and amount of training, but must meet a minimum requirement of 16 hours of training with a Department of Public Safety instructor. In addition to other school safety measures the district could take in the coming months, having a school marshal or guardian could offer an added layer of protection, she said. Fort Davis has utilized the school marshal program for a number of years, said Aguero. Board President Teresa Nunez inquired as to whether or not Porter had heard if any staff members were interested in participating in either of the programs, to which Porter assured her there were. We're not asking staff who are not comfortable with firearms to carry a weapon, said Porter. It's people who are already proficient and comfortable that want to do it. Porter said she recently hosted a walkthrough of the junior and high school campus with law enforcement officers from the city, county, and Texas Department of Public Safety, and they were set to return soon to familiarize themselves with the elementary campus as well. She said it was important to maintain strong relationships with the local law enforcement community. When asked if it would be possible to have both a hired SRO and school marshals or guardians, and whether or not they would be able to train alongside one another, Porter said it was, and that would be the preferred option. The concept of multiple layers of security was brought up again, with Porter commenting on something as mundane as signage playing a role. Having signs at the front of each entrance, it makes people think twice. If you have a sign that says, "Staff on this campus are armed and trained," said Porter. The discussion concluded with board members to do more research on the topic, weighing pros and cons of each plan. Aguero said it was unlikely a decision would be reached at the next board meeting, as they would need to involve the public in the dialogue before proceeding. "That way, we're not forcing something on our community," said Aguero. Aguero said he was in discussions with the city and Marfa Mayor Manny Baiza to hire a school resource officer, and that at this point they didn't want to rule out any options regarding school safety. "We're trying to look at all the different avenues we could have for protecting our kids," said Aguero. "That's the number one thing we're supposed to do." At City Council's regular meeting the following day, City Manager Mandy Roan took the floor to ask for Council's approval to apply for a grant that would help fund a full-time school resource officer. The grant, funded by the U.S. Department of Justice's 2022 Community-Oriented Policing Services, COPS, hiring program, would allow for the city to hire a police officer under the umbrella of the Marfa Police Department, with 75% of the officer's salary being paid by the grant and the other 25% by the school district. Ron said while it would have been ideal to have a formal discussion with school representatives before submitting the grant application, the timing in which they became aware of the funding and impending grant deadline required a decision sooner rather than later. At the next regularly scheduled City Council meeting, school representatives will be present to discuss the idea and, if needed, the city could always turn the grant down, she said. The COPS hiring program would allow for the city to pay up to 75% or $125,000 for 3 years for a full-time school resource officer whose sole responsibility is to be present at the school. MISD would reimburse the city for the remaining 25% of the officer's salary for the first 3 years and would be solely responsible for funding the officer's salary in the final year of their 4-year appointment. Roan said the job would include health and life insurance and the standard city employee benefits. Roan, who is working on the grant with Police Chief Steve Marquez, said the program seemed like a good fit for the Marfa community. "There are a couple of different things that the Department of Justice asks for a school resource officer to do, but it's things that our officers do anyway. It's community policing. It's reaching out to families," said Roan. Chief Marquez added Marfa PD would still have a presence at the school. While their department is currently unable to spare officers to travel with the school, which has been a request, he said, the school resource officer would be able to provide that service. After some back and forth in which council showed support for the initiative and welcomed further discussion with the school district, council unanimously approved the authorization to submit the grant proposal to the Department of Justice, with all non-grant expenses to be reimbursed to the city by MISD. The discussions come on the heels of the mass shooting at Robb Elementary in Uvalde, Texas, in which a gunman killed 19 students and 2 teachers. The police response to the shooting, in which officers waited to confront the gunman despite knowledge of injuries in the classrooms, is currently the subject of intense scrutiny and multiple investigations. In civil suit deposition, AG prosecutor says DA Ori White's conduct had raised concerns. By Allegra Hobbs, ALLEGRA at BigBenSentinel.com. Travis County. A prosecutor with the Texas Attorney General's Office said in sworn testimony that 83rd District Attorney Ori White's attempts last year to take back a case relinquished by his predecessor due to a conflict of interest had concerned the AG's office enough to prompt subpoenas and a planned hearing on the matter. Prosecutor Jeff Barr testified in a deposition as part of the civil lawsuit brought by former Assistant District Attorney Jerry Phillips against current DA Ori White, which alleges that White had wrongfully terminated Phillips for attempting to report improper and possibly illegal conduct within the office. In the sweeping lawsuit filed last fall, Phillips detailed several instances of alleged corruption or cronyism and claims that his refusal to participate in those acts and his attempted whistleblowing led to his firing. White has denied the allegations and pledged to fight the suit, calling it false. Among the claims in the suit is Phillips' allegation that Brewster County Attorney Steve Houston pressured White to take back a felony criminal case against Houston's grandson that White's predecessor, Sandy Wilson, had relinquished to the AG's office in order to avoid the appearance of impartiality, citing a personal and professional relationship with the elder Houston. After taking office in early 2021, White moved to take the case back. Email correspondence attached to the suit shows Phillips discouraging White's attempts to reclaim the case, warning that it might create the appearance of repaying political support. Still, White filed a motion to take back the case, though he dropped the motion one day before a scheduled hearing on the matter. Barr, a prosecutor with the AG's office who handled the case in question, testified that White's request had struck him as unusual, that the timing of the request, shortly after the AG's office had offered Houston's grandson, Michael Houston, a plea offer, was suspect, and that it raised enough suspicions or smoke about White's impartiality to prompt him to issue subpoenas to those involved and pursue a hearing. Told him that White had offered an alternative plea offer, despite the case residing in the AG's jurisdiction. Barr, as one of several witnesses, including current and former elected officials, to be deposed in the case. His deposition was taken by one of Phillips' attorneys, Jody Cole. On May 31st, and a transcript was entered into the public case file last week. The attorney present at the deposition to represent the defendant, Stephen Kaiser, objected throughout to Cole's line of questioning. By Barr's telling, the brief conflict began in February 2021, shortly after he had extended a preliminary plea offer to Michael Houston through McDermott. The defense attorney then contacted Barr to express concern about the severity of the offer and also said that he had received another offer from the district attorney. Barr said the details of that offer were never disclosed to him. Shortly afterwards, Barr said he was contacted by White, first by voicemail, then by email, who said he wanted the case back. Quote, "I do not have any conflict in this matter," end quote, White wrote in the email, which is included in the case's exhibits. Quote, "It is not typical in my experience at the AG's office to receive those types of calls," end quote, said Barr. White then filed a motion to remove Barr as DA pro tem. Barr said that his superior, Lisa Tanner, spoke with White around that time and walked away from the call under the impression that White was not moving forward with the motion, so Barr filed a document with the court saying the issue was moot. Barr subsequently heard from White again, telling him he had made an incorrect representation to the court. He was not withdrawing the motion, and a judge would ultimately decide whether to grant it or not. Barr testified that there were concerns within his office about the actions, especially considering the supposed alternative plea bargain. There was concern on our end that he might be taking this case back, maybe because of relationship reasons, maybe because he could not be impartial in his review, he said. We didn't know that for certain, but we certainly wanted to figure it out. We weren't getting the plea bargain. They weren't handing over the plea bargain that he had offered. We were concerned about his authority to even give a plea bargain. Barr was, quote, given the green light to aggressively pursue a hearing, end quote, on the matter, he said, and served subpoenas to White, McDermott, Houston, and staff within the DA's office. McDermott retained a lawyer who filed a motion to quash the subpoena, stating that his client did not have any document responses and asserted his Fifth Amendment rights. Barr said he was ready to fight the motion in court and to attempt to get the subpoenaed individuals on the witness stand. Shortly before a hearing was to take place, White withdrew his motion, bringing the conflict to a close. Phillips' suit against White as head of the 83rd Judicial District Attorney's Office is unfolding in the 53rd Judicial District in Travis County. Phillips had initially included Brewster, Pecos, Presidio, and Jeff Davis counties as defendants in the suit. But when those counties attempted to move the case into a local district court, he non-suited the counties, concerned an impartial hearing would not be possible otherwise. Phillips had also sued White as an individual, as well as in his capacity as DA, but a Travis County judge recently ruled that the suit against White, the individual, should be dismissed.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Fort Stockton Pioneer for Thursday, June 16th, 2022. Annexation denied by City Council, by Nathan Heuer. A zoning distinction for the land which the Triple Crown Estates subdivision was set to be developed on was at the root of the property's annexation denial on June 13th at the regular council meeting. Fort Stockton City Councilman Darren Hodges made a motion to annex the 20.1 acres of land located between Greasewood and Sycamore for the proposed 43-lot subdivision. A lack of a second to Hodges' motion prevented the annexation from going to a vote and therefore denied. What I like is it brings value to the city, but it's also something we can control. We can zone it how we want. We're the city, that's our decision, he explained towards the conclusion of Monday's meeting. I think there were some red flags that need to be addressed, and if they're brought back and requested, we'll consider it. If it comes into the city, we'll certainly zone it to what we think will minimize concerns and maximize values. Numerous people in attendance of a max capacity audience at City Hall voiced their concern regarding apartments and or duplexes being potentially built on the land. Once it's classified for multifamily, what leverage do you have as far as what kind of buildings that you have constructed there? Al Haney said. City Councilman Reuben Falcon expressed his desire to have the zoning distinction changed by property owner Andy Rivera, if he so chooses to apply for annexation again. I would be more welcoming to the application that goes to planning and zoning from scratch that shows SF1. I want it for the city, and I want the taxes from it, and code to have oversight on the construction. I want the city engineer to see how the streets are laid out. If they change theirs to secure SF1, not just word of mouth, I think that would be more receptive to the community. Councilman James Warnick shared a similar stance as his fellow councilman. SF1 would be more appropriate for me. It's got a pretty good design. I know it needs a little work on it, but I don't have any problem with that. That's tax base for the city coming in. Newly elected Councilman R.J. Bernal explained his reasoning for not voting on the annexation. When you have apartment complexes, you have a lot of people. The person that rents that place should be the only one living in it, besides their kids. But when they bring in who they want, I think that's when we would have problems with safety for our kids. Councilman and Mayor Pro Tem Paul Casillas stated at the end of Monday's meeting that if anything is presented to the council again for annexation, they'll consider it and go through the appropriate procedures at that time. Rivera stated at the beginning of the public hearing that Triple Crown Estates would feature single-family upper-class homes if developed down the road. This development is much needed for the community as it is for the city. We are in much need of new homes in the city, and I believe this is a major reason for no growth. The developing of this project will bring many jobs. As for the city, they would benefit off the taxes and utilities for a lifetime. AMB will make a one-time profit on the project, but the city of Fort Stockton would benefit for a lifetime. The annexation for the 5 lots owned by Fort Stockton Independent School District, located across the middle school, did not pass after the agenda item did not receive a motion at Monday's meeting. The land, which was sold to the school district by AMB Prestige last year, was potentially a destination for the next phase of school housing. Numerous citizens who spoke on the matter stated their issues with the annexation, ranging from the safety of children to quantity of housing already available in the community. Available housing for teachers is not the problem. B3 properties, Century 21, Hacienda properties, all have vacancies, Tom Ingram said. Another citizen who spoke at the council's podium, Richard Blanchard, shared a similar sentiment and was concerned over student safety. You call the property managers, there's plenty of property available for teachers. I'm definitely against the rezoning of this. It took me 20 years to get me to where my house is now, and I don't appreciate somebody coming in and my property value decreasing, traffic increasing, safety of our students. Kids walk by my house every day. God forbid somebody run over one because they're not paying attention with the increased traffic through there. We need to look after the safety of our kids. Councilman Falcon added his thoughts on the school's housing. I think the school has way too much housing. You vote your interest, and my interest was that the school does not need any more property. A 36-month lease for 13 new laptops for the Fort Stockton Police Department was approved on Monday at the City Council meeting. The city will use part of their remaining balance from the American Rescue Plan Fund, which was at $166,000, before the lease agreement, according to City Manager Frank Rodriguez. The laptop's lease will cost $24,640 per year. After 3 years, the city will have the option to receive a technology refresh to prevent outdated equipment. Fort Stockton Assistant Police Chief Ernesto Velasquez explained that a shift to the new Peacemaker computers will enable the department to have every officer on the same operating system. We've been dealt a hard blow to some of our MDTs on our vehicles right now. We have a combination of Panasonic and G-Techs. They're not interchangeable in the vehicles, so if the vehicle is down, you can't put another officer on there without having to change the computer and user. These will also help us get up to speed. Keep in mind, Windows 10 is about to be obsolete, so we have to keep up with the times. According to the Peacemaker Technologies website, their rugged convertible laptops feature integration of convertible touchscreens, Intel 10th generation processors, full-size keyboards, as well as operational front cameras for facial recognition and advanced identity verification for secure data access. As part of the lease, Peacemaker Technologies will install the devices for the police department. The Fort Stockton Economic Development Corporation will be adding a full-time maintenance personnel employee in the near future after the approval of the position was granted by the City Council. According to Fort Stockton EDC Director Remy Ramos, the growth and function of the Fort Stockton Convention Center grew the demand for the position. CVB has 2 maintenance people that we use here, and then when they acquired the convention center, we tried to have maintenance people go there and here, and it was too much, especially right now during the summer where staff is constantly growing. The wind and trash have been atrocious. It'll be a full-time position. Ramos explained that he will attempt to hire internally from the city first before making the position open to the public. The job will receive standard utility worker pay, according to Ramos. FSISD to revamp CTE programs. Despite Bond Proposition A not passing during the May 7th election, the Fort Stockton Independent School District decided to move forward with $500,000 of improvements to get their career and technology education programs revived. The school district approved the withdrawal of the money from their fund balance at a special meeting on June the 8th. We know that Bond Proposition A specifically failed, and that was one that had all kinds of improvements in it, including all of our campuses with state-of-the-art equipment, Superintendent Zamora said. But one of the things that we were pushing in our formats was the advancement of our career and technology education programs. We cannot move forward with the state-of-the-art facilities that we hope to bring to our students at this point, but we cannot afford to not push forward. The district's Future Farmers of America, cosmetology, ag science, and auto tech programs were those mentioned that will benefit from the funds. Specifically, the auto tech and cosmetology programs will receive $150,000 each to improve their current facilities and acquire materials to get the programs off the ground. The remaining $200,000 will go to additional CTE program needs. Zamora explained that Roy Alvarado, assistant superintendent, and dual credit has inquired about costs for materials and other costs related to having the improvements completed by next school year. Mr. Alvarado has put forth some of the preliminary costs that we are looking at so we can get these things underway. We believe that this $500,000 will get us pretty far into being able to provide what we need. We're going to use this $500,000 and work in between. If the cosmetology doesn't cost quite as much as projected, we're going to put that money into some of the other programs. Alvarado added the different programs significantly vary in terms of need. Looking at the infrastructure of some of the facilities, some of them are not too far from where we need to be, and some of them are going to need more work. The venue is there. The shell of what is used to be, of what it used to be, is still there, and I think we can improve where it needs to be. Brulang Cafe Express, owned by local pharmacist Gavin Thomas and Leslie Rodriguez, opened its doors for the first time to the public on May 25th. The business, located at 302 East Dickinson, offers items that you can find nowhere else in town, such as their Nitro Cold Brew. Thomas said the business has big plans in the future, which includes expanding their food menu and specialty drinks. See the cafe's business spotlight story in next week's paper. Rooney Park in Fort Stockton, Sheffield Park, and Ira Ann's Alley-Oop Park will be three locations in Pecos County without any firework restriction on July 4th. The Pecos County Commissioner's Court approved a restriction at their regular meeting for fireworks classified as skyrockets with sticks and missiles with fins in any portion of the unincorporated area of Pecos County. According to the order restriction, no person may sell, detonate, ignite, or in any way use fireworks as previously described. An offense under the order is a Class C misdemeanor. A person commits an offense if the person knowingly or intentionally violates a prohibition established by the order. The order does not prohibit common fireworks, Class C explosives, or large firework devices that are designed primarily to produce visible or audible effects by combustion, deflagration, or detonation, classified as Class B explosives. The Annie Riggs Memorial Museum hosted its second Summer Off the Patio concert on Thursday, June 9th. The show featured singer Stephen Morris on guitar, accompanied by Luis Coutinho on the drums. Together, the pair put on a performance of Americana music as the audience reclined around the patio in the warmth of a golden sunset. The next concert will welcome back Robin Shane on Thursday, June 23rd. The country songwriter will be returning to Fort Stockton and hitting the Annie Riggs Museum stage from 7 to 9 p.m. The Easy Listening Concert had 65 people in attendance with a variety of foods and cold beverages made available to the crowd. Longtime Fort Stockton resident to complete Spartan trifecta. Fort Stockton resident Hector Jimenez has had one mentality that has helped guide him to success in life and become the father he strives to be day in and day out. Never give up and have faith in the support system behind you. It's mind over matter. Just keep going. I don't give up, especially when I got people like my wife who always shows to support me. Growing up, Jimenez had a knack for long-distance running, and the Eagle Pass native put his God-given ability to use during his youth. Jimenez broke numerous long-distance running records growing up before transitioning to different sports later on in high school. "I always enjoyed running and being active growing up," he said. "I was and still am very competitive." Jimenez moved to Fort Stockton in 2007 and initially worked in the oil field, performing various roles. The 15-year Fort Stockton resident started his own mechanic business, Hector's Tire and Auto Repair, upon leaving the oil field, and has since found a great deal of success while running his own company. "I built something to get out city limits and do my own thing," Jimenez explained. "I work a lot of hours, but I'm thankful to have my own business and to support my family." Close friend Darren Hodges expanded on Jimenez's abilities as a mechanic during a joint interview a week ago, stating that his profession was the beginning of their friendship 2 years ago. "I bought an RV on eBay, and it was cheap, because it needed a lot of work. So Jerome at Fort Stockton Body Shop recommended me to Hector Jimenez. He said that Hector is a great mechanic. He can go through and tell you what needs to be fixed. He won't overcharge you, and he's really good at what he does." Jimenez went on to fix the RV and many more vehicles that needed repairs by the Hodges family, and his work did not disappoint. "My dad, of course, had those old cars, and he was able to work on those," Hodges said. "What began as relationship as a client and businessman soon turned into a friendship that was built upon a foundation of commonalities. We have a lot in common. We're family men. He's got 5 kids. I've got 4. We're family people," Hodges said. This past year, the competitive juices began to flow once again for Jimenez, and it led the Eagle Pass native to competing in his first Spartan race. "I've been wanting to do the Spartan race for 2 to 3 years, he said. "I'm always active and stuff, but it's not the same. Being active is not the same as actually doing runs and obstacles. The Spartan race is an extreme wellness platform that helps humans become unbreakable, according to the event's website. The race series consists of 3 main events, which are also known as the Trifecta, the Spartan Race Ultimate Annual Challenge. In order to receive the most coveted obstacle course racing medal, an individual must complete the Trifecta. The Trifecta consists of a 5K race with 20 obstacles, Spartan Sprint or Station, a 10K race with 25 obstacles, Spartan Super, and a 21K race with 30 obstacles, Spartan Beast. Jimenez has completed 2 of the 3 trifecta races this year and plans to finish the 3-part series at the Dallas Spartan event weekend in Granbury on October 22nd. "I want to be able to complete the challenge and go through everything, not just walk through it. To me, it's competing and proving to myself and family that I can do it." Hodges will be supporting Jimenez's efforts to reach his current goal of completing the trifecta by sponsoring him and his family for the competition. The city councilman and local businessman will also be sponsoring the Jimenez trip to Arlington on June 18th for the Spartan Race Station 5K AT&T Stadium, an event that Jimenez's daughter, Sophia, 6, also plans to compete in during the kids' race. "She told me that she really wants to get a medal like me," Hector said.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahans News for Thursday, June 9th. State-of-the-art physical therapy cardio unit now open in Monahans. The story was written by Jan Cranfield. The Ward Memorial Hospital's newly christened Physical Therapy Cardio Unit is a state-of-the-art addition to the services offered to Ward County and surrounding area patients. Humberto Zubia, Physical Therapy Director, gave the news a tour of the facility and explained all the equipment. Quote, "We are very proud of our physical therapy unit, and with all the equipment available, we can help in many different ways to get patients back to a normal life as quick as possible," Zubia said. The pool is high-tech water therapy. A treadmill in the bottom of the pool with cameras in the pool wall aimed at a patient's feet can record walking speed and functioning ability of a patient, which is monitored by the physical therapist assistants Homer Peak and Rick Calabria on the computer screens. The treadmill speed can be controlled as well as the water resistance, which can be increased or decreased for a more or less physical workout. Pool water levels can be lowered and raised in a matter of seconds, draining into a reservoir holding system. A swing arm lift chair is used for patients who cannot use the conventional steps down into the pool. Many therapeutic water workouts are performed in the water, which decreases weight on joints or injured body areas to promote healing. Quote, "We have equipment here that is not even available in Odessa or Midland," Peak said, smiling. A high-tech SmartFit board occupies a place in the main gym room. SmartFit is a technology that scales cognitive demand while concurrently executing a wide variety of physical movements and skills. The SmartFit can be used for simultaneous mental and physical exercises referred to as dual tasking. This includes dual tasking orthopedic rehabilitation exercises, dual tasking neurological rehabilitation exercises focused on stroke, concussion, and sensory integration. It can be used for dual tasking motor rehabilitation exercises for slowing the onset of Parkinson's and engaging dual tasking brain health exercises for slowing the onset of aging. Elliptical bikes and regular stationary bikes line the west wall of the main exercise room. Each bike has its own special use for patient rehabilitation, such as the elliptical bikes are best for knee therapy because of the reduced stress placed on the knees. Elliptical bikes are low impact on the knee joints, but can be adjusted to increase resistance. The elliptical bikes used at the PT unit also have ski poles for an upper body workout as well as, and along with, the knee therapy. Also, in the exercise machine section are rowing machines for shoulder and arm workouts. Knee and leg extension machines can be used for post-op knee surgery. Shoulder press therapy machines, an upright whole gym workout unit, treadmill with side rails for patients with balance issues, and parallel bars for patients who are having to basically learn to walk again after illnesses such as strokes. A cardio section takes its place in the corner of the west wall, which includes a bike, treadmill, and heart monitoring equipment. Patients, post and pre-surgery, are monitored by a cardio-physical therapist while using the bike, treadmill, or while walking around the main gym room. Joy Arnold is the Director of Respiratory Sleep Cardiopulmonary Rehabilitation, and Gladys De La Rosas is the respiratory therapist. Four treatment rooms contain electrical stimulation units, along with ultrasound for massage therapy. One treatment room has a traction table, and another has more advanced ultrasound equipment. The Piezo Wave 2 is a deep tissue static, stationary with a swing arm, ultrasound machine. Handheld smaller ultrasound wands are used for smaller areas. Hand and finger therapy can be addressed with focused laser light or a countertop unit filled with a liquid gel for soaking hands and fingers. Children have their own therapy room and are worked with on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Patients can continue therapy on their own after being released by a physician for a monthly membership. Quote, "We have a restorative program that allows released patients to continue their therapy on their own. A $36 a month membership allows patients access to all the facilities," Ward Memorial Hospital Administrator CEO Leticia Rodriguez said. The physical therapy unit is located at 420 South Ike Street, with hours of 8 to 12 and 1 to 5 Monday through Friday. Sparks fly during storm last week. A Friday night thunderstorm hit Monahans around 9 p.m. with an abundance of lightning and thunder. Rain amounts were reported as about 3/10 of an inch on the north and southwest side of Monahans to a quarter inch measured in the southeast part of town. Moderate marble-sized hail and high winds accompanied the storm. South of Grand Falls received about 1/4 of an inch of rainfall. Reports of a tornado close to Wink were unconfirmed. A fire on top of an Encore electrical service pole located at 601 West 2nd Street was reported to Monahans Fire Department. High wind was the possible cause of the pole crossbar breaking and letting hot wires touch, causing an electrical fire on top of the pole. The pole, shared by Encore and Suddenlink, has been replaced. Two other utility service poles suffered damage, one at 2nd and Nancy, and one at 6th and Gary. Both have been repaired by Encore. Two arrested after taking county truck for joyride. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. Monahans Police Department arrested two individuals in a stolen Ward County truck last Wednesday afternoon. Ward County Sheriff's Office received a call in reference to the stolen county 2020 Ford F-150 from the county yard at the corner of 31st and Helen Streets. Quote, "County Commissioner Dexter Nichols called to say the truck, which displays a county seal logo on the driver and passenger doors, was stolen from the county shop around noon," Ward County Sheriff Ferran Valle said. Monahans Police Department officers heard the call come over the scanners and began searching for the truck. Quote, "Officer Jeremy Kynes spotted the truck on the South Side Service Road near Outwest Veterinary Services. Once it was confirmed that it was in fact the missing county truck, he conducted a felony stop on the truck," MPD Captain Christopher Quintana said. The driver was identified as Kwame Lamar Mosby, age 27, of Fort Stockton, and the passenger in the truck was Casey Jeanette Gonzalez, age 42, of 603 North Main. Quote, "Mosby was subsequently taken into custody and charged with the truck theft. Gonzalez was detained, and it was later determined she was in possession of several possible stolen items," Quintana said. Gonzalez was charged with theft of property more than $100, less than $750. She was also booked on two outstanding warrants for burglary of a habitation, a second-degree felony, and credit debit card abuse, a state jail felony. Mosby was charged with unauthorized use of a vehicle, a state jail felony. The truck was released back to the county with no obvious damage, Valle said. Gonzalez's bond was set at $30,000, and Mosby was given a bond of $7,500. Both remain in custody in lieu of posting the bonds. Cutting tools spark fire at local junkyard. Fire conditions remain high. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. On Monday, June 6th, members of the Monahans Volunteer Fire Department responded to a call of a vehicle on fire in a junkyard in the 2200 block of West 4th. Quote, "The fire sparked after a worker was using cutting tools to cut up a junked car which still had gas in it," Fire Department Captain Randy Crabtree said. No injuries were reported in the fire, and no other vehicles caught fire. Local firemen have remained busy so far this week with fires. The department was called out early Tuesday morning at 3:30 a.m. in reference to a grass fire. Quote, "It was called in as a grass fire, but turned out to be an outbuilding and a couple of old barns on fire behind 1409 West 26th Street," Crabtree said. Crabtree added, "It wasn't clear how the fires began, but other surrounding structures were not damaged." Tuesday, around 4:15 p.m., firefighters responded to mile marker 92 to a call of a paper truck on fire. Quote, "This was actually in Ector County, but they called us since we are closer," Crabtree said. The flatbed trailer was on fire, which was loaded with crushed paper and was on the side of the eastbound lanes of I-20. Quote, "It probably took us a couple of hours to get this fire out and several thousand gallons of water. Traffic was halted on the interstate to allow us to get the fire trucks out there and safely put the fire out," he said. A small grass fire in the alley behind 1206 South Leon came in late Tuesday night. Quote, "This fire was really small and burned up to the dumpster, but did not burn the dumpster. We were able to keep it contained, and nothing was damaged as a result," he said. Quote, "Even though the recent fires have all been somewhat small and no major damage, people need to be more cautious. Fires can turn very dangerous really quickly, especially since we have seen very windy conditions recently and very little rain," Crabtree said. As a reminder, Ward County is still under a burn ban. The outdoor burn ban prohibits any outdoor burning in unincorporated areas of the county. However, the ban does not prohibit the burning of household trash in containers covered by grating, outdoor cooking, or burning in metal pits and grills, including the burning of wood for such purpose, or other outdoor burning activities as permitted by the Ward County Fire Marshal in his sole discretion. Alleged porch pirate caught with stolen items in backpack. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. Ward County Sheriff's deputies arrested a suspected porch pirate on May 25th after he was caught with missing items on his person. Quote, "One of our deputies was patrolling in the 2000 block of West Seeley when he observed a male individual walking across Seeley Street diagonally. The deputy made contact with the individual, identified as Gary Wayne Blackman, age 43, of Wickett," Ward County Sheriff Frayron Vallier said. "While speaking with Blackman, the deputy noticed he was carrying a brand new backpack. Quote, the deputy asked Blackman what he had in the backpack, and he said kids' toys he found in a dumpster," Vallier said. With consent from Blackman, the deputy searched the backpack and found new toys in their original packaging. Quote, a post was made on social media of locating the possible stolen property. On May 26th, a female victim came into the office and stated she had a package stolen off her porch with items that matched the description of the toys found in Blackman's possession, Vallier added. A warrant was issued for Blackman's arrest, and he was subsequently arrested on June 4th and charged with theft of mail less than 10 addresses. Quote, charges through the postal services is based on the amount of addresses victimized on the dollar amount, therefore stealing from less than 10 addresses is a state jail felony, Valle said. Blackman's bond was set at $5,000, and he remains in custody in lieu of posting the bond. Sandoval given 10 years in prison on 2012 charges. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. A Pecos man who was sentenced to 12 years probation for the 2012 burglary of a home in Barstow, as well as setting the home on fire, has now been ordered to serve a 10-year prison sentence. 42-year-old Fortino Jacob Sandoval of Pecos pleaded guilty to the crime on May 17, 2013, in the 143rd Judicial District Court and was sentenced to 10 years confinement in the Institutional Division of the Texas Department of Criminal Justice, 6 years deferred adjudication on each charge. Deferred adjudication is a form of plea deal that enables a person to avoid a trial and possible conviction. The defendant can enter a plea of guilty or no contest to a charge in exchange for deferred adjudication, which means the judge doesn't find them guilty, but rather defers any finding of guilt in exchange for the acceptance of an alternative course of action. Since that time, Sandoval violated the terms of his probated sentence several times for drug charges and other unspecified charges. On May 29th, Sandoval appeared in front of 143rd Judicial District Judge Mike Swanson, where he was adjudicated on his guilt and ordered to serve 10 years in prison. The charges in which Sandoval was adjudicated on occurred on February 18, 2012, when Sandoval intentionally entered a habitation without consent of owner Yesenia Cortez with the intent to assault her. Sandoval also destroyed the home located at 321 Barstow Avenue in Barstow by causing an explosion or fire at the home by igniting combustible material. Sandoval was further ordered to pay a $6,000 fine, $712 in court costs. He was also given credit for 816 days time served. 143rd District Attorney Randall W. Reynolds served as attorney for the state on the case.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.